The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
So, for example, from that point of view, I think it's helpful to remember how you understand the making of images or idols in animistic culture. Through the image, through what we call the idol, man begins to sort of feel that the powers habitually working through them are being sort of somehow subtracted from deity and then stored up in various forms of magic. So the magically manipulated idol or object of worship then in animism inevitably tends to become a second god alongside of the original one, because you can pour all the power in there. You can control that. And the image then in an animistic society is not a symbol. It becomes a rival or substitute of the god. So, for example, a sample of this is the Old Testament account of the golden calf. Here is Noah. The calf becomes, at the foot of Mount Sinai, a sort of visible representation of Jehovah, and then, under the influence of Egyptian syncretism, magical syncretism, it sort of leads straightway to polytheism. So what did the Israelites cry out when they make the golden calf? These be thy gods, O Israel, that have led thee out of the land of Egypt. Notice the plural. Here are the alternative systems. And the image then retains this power. And for that reason, I think all of this has got to be related to the first and the second commandments. Jehovah is the only one who has the right to worship. He retains that exclusive right to Israel's worship, and that right to exclusive worship now becomes endangered as soon as images are introduced into culture. So the first commandment says you can only have one God, and the second commandment strikes at the chief source of danger for the observance of the first commandment, the making of idols, but very closely related. So idolatry in the Old Testament means partly the worship of other gods, partly the worship of images. And sometimes it's very hard to figure out which is which. And that's very characteristic.
One thing I think is interesting in reading many passages in the Old Testament, particularly in Genesis, is the syncretism that's present. I'm thinking particularly the instance of Jacob and his relationship with Laban when he leaves, and Rebekah takes one of Laban's gods and hides it. And when you first are introduced to Laban, you think, this is an okay guy. Obviously, he's a good, solid theist. He graduated from Westminster Seminary.
Right.
And then you find out that he's been shacking up with a little god somewhere, and he's really playing both ends of the fence. He's very offended by the fact. He vows that he's going to, in fact, Jacob says, you can kill the person that you find has stolen this. It's kind of interesting that there would be that contact.
Yeah, it's the same thing is tied in also with the third commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. In the West, I think we have tended to translate that as don't use four letter words. I don't think it means that at all, and it seems to me it's related to the whole question of magic, and to the Lord's response, as it were, to those who are trying to control God's divine activity through making images. Or, part of magic was word magic, where you learn certain incantations, certain phrases, which become control phrases. Hinduism, you know, the mantra. And the mantra becomes the hidden phrase, secret known only to you, by which you are brought into harmony with the cosmic order. In voodoo, there are the secret words or incantations by which you seek to control the underworld. In traditional animism, very characteristic of it. So, the most potent form of word magic is name magic, in which you are given a name, and through the pronouncing of some supernatural, the name of some supernatural entity, you thereby sort of control or gain the power or access to the power of that supernatural deity whose name has become yours, right? Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And I think what's going on there is, to my mind, that commandment is specifically prohibiting that magical use of the name of Jehovah to the Israelites. When you go into the land and you're going to see Canaanite ancestor worship, you're going to behold name magic being used all around you. You may not resort to attempting to control Jehovah by simply pronouncing his name. God is not a God who can be tied down to your tongue, nor can you use or manipulate the power of God by taking his name and using it. You cannot take the name of the Lord in such vanity. And the Lord won't hold you guiltless. There's a lot more there than just, you know, be careful what kind of words you use in polite conversation. So even today, for example, I think this has come down in contemporary and even in North American society, the name of Jesus Christ is used as a swear word, right? Or the name of God. And basically, what are you saying when you swear? Well, the most common opprobrium in the English language is you're asking for the judgment of God on this hammer that's just hit you on the thumb. Or you're asking that God would judge this chair off of which you've just fallen. Or this flat tire which has just appeared on your automobile. And those are all basically curse words, in which you're attempting through magic to curse that flat tire or that chair or that awful hammer or even occasionally a wife or child. the whole point is sort of a leftover in secular Western society of animism. Still there and still very awesome, but you can't call out on the name of Jehovah to fulfill these evil supernatural purposes. The Lord will not allow you to use his name to injure an enemy or pronounce some blessing on yourself or a member of your family. The core of the sin that's covered by that commandment still remains trying to manipulate God.
I think it says from my Hebrew studies, I remember that's one word. Lift up, isn't that the word? Nasa.
Oh, certainly.
Lift up.
Yes, you caught it right. It's lift up, huh?
It's also not lift up the name of the Lord your God. Remember, Voss does something on the biblical theology, the third commandment, kind of the incantation, lifting up, you know, proclaiming in a wrong way the name of God.
Yeah, but it's tied in with animism. Go ahead.
This may be a little bit off the topic, but referring back to some of your earlier notes just a couple, 3 minutes ago, I'm having a problem understanding exactly what you mean by magic. I'm seeing two different categories.
Okay.
One, the category like talking about the golden calf or the voodoo where there is power.
Yeah.
Invested in, upon this image. Then I'm also thinking of magic in terms of entertainment, of a magic show where people do tricks.
Okay.
In fact, there's a guy who works with Campus Crusade, I believe, who does these things as a presentation. What's his name?
Andre Cole.
Right, right. And is there a difference Can you call one magic and the other
one you can get free and the other one you pay for?
He paid for it yesterday. Maybe he's thinking about it.
And with one you have to learn the four spiritual laws, and the other one you can get without them.
One is just optical illusion.
Yeah, I think one is sleight of hand optical
illusion. Yeah.
Even
then, I've never gone into the history of magic. But even then, probably, you know, in the recesses of time, there were barriers across which what we now see pretty clearly as two separate kinds of functioning entities were once one. So that, you know, the art of magic now, as we understand it, you know, the card tricks and the illusions and the cutting in half and all that, that originally those things were also thought within a traditional religion to be what you were capable of doing in terms of controlling the cosmos around you. Only now the religious significance that ties behind that is all gone, and now we have just simply the tricks. But I'm thinking much more in terms of that first thing you outlined, Tom.
I think the two run together. Even in America, I've talked to different people. One man that lives in a small town in Michigan where they have a convention for magicians every year, and Houdini and different ones have come there. He believes, he's a Christian, he believes that a lot of the magicians is totally sleight of hand, but he believes that sometimes they go further over and actually get into something that he would call demonic power. He believes that a lot of the tricks that they're doing cannot be explained simply by sleight of hand. He doesn't mean all magicians.
Yeah,
some.
Yeah. Huh? Well, it's the
gospel magic.
Yeah.
I love that.
Like, well, that's
the haunted houses that a lot of Christian organizations use for evangelism, the use of fear and manipulation. I've always struggled with that.
Everybody's fun.
Yeah.
Yes, more the latter. You know, one of the things Mark and Dane and I were going home yesterday, and in the car I mentioned that there's trying to think through these all these trends and to think about how to present the gospel in terms of alternatives to all of this. One of the terms particularly Alan Tippett has adopted in order to help us see the significance of animism is to see it as a power. And the gospel then and its presentation to the animist as a power encounter, basically in which, as it were, using our theological language, it's the encounter of the power of the kingdom of God with the power of the kingdom of Satan. And more recently, it's interesting, at Fuller Seminary, Peter Wagner has been moving much more into a study of some of these very questions, and particularly the question of miracles in relationship to animistic power encounters. About 2 months ago or 3 months ago, Christian Life magazine, this is published by the editors Robert Walker, I believe out of Minneapolis, someplace in the Midwest. It is a magazine which is a monthly magazine and something along the order of Moody, more popular in its treatment, probably very supportive of the, maybe characterized as a strong supporter of the charismatic movement. There was a special issue two or three issues back on one course that is now being taught at Fuller Seminary by Pete Wagner, and I'm going to get Mark to give me an idea, help us out here, but a little. But as I understood it in the Moody Monthly thing, the course is something on church growth, signs, and miracles. And what Pete is doing now is investigating the relationship between supernatural displays of kingdom power and the growth of the church. And so in this course, for example, one of the things they do is one of the teachers, what's that guy's name?
I don't know, his first name is John. He's a pastor at the, it's called the Vineyard.
Roger gave us an article.
Same one as Christian. Yeah. He's a pastor in a church called the Vineyard, which is an offshoot of Calvary Chapel that Chuck Smith founded. In fact, they were somewhat ostracized because Chuck Smith felt they were too charismatic. He wanted to be no longer Calvary Chapel, but called another vineyard, they're called.
But they have, apparently, the lectures. Pete gives the lectures. And then students are, they don't have to, but if they want to, they're encouraged to go then to the vineyard and to participate in laying on of hands, speaking in tongues, but specifically in the performing of miracles and supernatural healings. And I think the particular issue is really is interesting to read. The whole that whole issue is nothing but articles on that course and the things going on in it. I'd encourage you to read it and think it through. If nothing else, you know, whatever your position on these particular areas, you're going to have to wrestle pretty seriously with, you know, what is the place within evangelism to animistic cultures for supernatural displays of the power of God. And I think that's what Wagner is struggling with in terms of both how you understand not only just simply the charismatic church, but even how you yourself are going to teach and preach and share in terms of miracles as open displays of the supernatural power of God today. We were talking about it because in Uganda, one of the people who has had a tremendous impact in Uganda, I don't think I'm over-exaggerating, is Morris Cirillo, who is an evangelist, has a very large headquarters in San Diego, California, and conducts healing and meetings, revival meetings all over the world, in connection and performs miracles, things like that. And his following in Uganda is really tremendous. Tied in with it, I find myself asking the same questions in Korea about the significance of Pastor Cho, Paul Cho Yong-gi, in the Full Gospel Assemblies of God Church, which has now, over 25,000 members? It's supposed to be the largest church now in the world, growing fantastically. When I first went to Korea in 1960, it was a tent around the corner from where I lived. And now it's the largest church in the world.
Basakali prophets that are emerging in our area. And usually their main characteristic is that they supposedly perform healings. And this is something, of course, traditionally missionaries in our area have such a problem to. But it's meeting a real felt need. Because I suppose we've had a dualism. We preach the gospel at the same time we have brought medicine, but it's been a Western medicine. And it hasn't been meeting the real felt need of the people. And this is really catching on, not just in our area, but all over Africa, you know. Yeah. I think it's because we have had sort of a limited view of miracles and supernatural healing, especially.
In terms also of the African Independent Church, one of the things that I sense as I read just some of the documents is that almost consistently in the African Independent Churches, you have somewhere or other a pretty heavy emphasis on the doing of miracles, maybe through the hand of the prophet leader or disciples, but very, very strong.
Another thing that I was wondering about, why would you say, like I mentioned in the paper that I wrote, that in our area, most of the animistic religion, let's say ancestor spirits, nature spirits, and all this, a lot of this is really less important now. But magic and witchcraft are still growing, are still very important. I'd be interested in hearing. I expressed a few ideas why I thought. How would you explain that?
Hang on to that one. In terms of, I don't want this to become a sort of a touch therapy session, but how do you folks handle something like the question of miracles in terms of an animistic culture? Related to it, for example, one of the things that surely you've noticed if you visited in the black churches in the United States is that there is proportionately a great difference of emphases within the black and the white churches of the United States on this very question. The black churches are, with great freedom and normality, You know, nothing out of the ordinary will see very visible, clear displays of the supernatural healing of God. Those of us who've been raised particularly in a very tight tradition, like the one that surrounds Westminster, will have many, many more questions about that kind of thing. All right, how are you going to handle that? Suppose some of you are going to minister like Ian is in the black churches of the inner city. And others of you are going to work Uganda, in India, the Zaire, Pakistan, and you're going to be working with animistic groups that have these feelings. How will you handle the question of miracles? Do you believe that God performs miracles today? You want me to turn off the tape?
Hollis and I were talking about that on our way back from Bender after having seen a film on the African Independent Churches. And my personal opinion on it is I believe the miracles of the Bible were to authenticate the ministry of Jesus. They were to give him validity. They were the things that really stirred people up. Mm. And I feel, and I'm very open to being corrected or whatever, but I think that in cultures, in societies where the gospel has not penetrated, and particularly among people that cannot read or write and they don't have the Bible that authenticates the ministry of Jesus today for us, that miracles can be a very valid form still today to validate that which Jesus has done. And I feel that once, in fact, I was just talking to Joe Novus, I had breakfast with him, and in the culture and the people with whom I work, being healed is a very important thing because they're poor and they don't have money for medical. And the gospel has not made large inroads into that community. And I feel strongly that there's a real place for a healing ministry there, not in the terms of you know, somebody here in the States that has big auditoriums and all that kind of thing. And as I was talking, sharing this with Joe, he said, you know, if you would do that kind of thing and see that this person was healed, you should be just as surprised as them, knowing that it was God who did it, and be expecting that once the church got established, that this would drop away. And that's sort of the way I view that. And, you know, boy, I may be way out of left field, but it makes
okay.
It a whole lot older.
Doesn't hurt a bit. Norm?
I tend to look at it as not a question of whether miracles occur today or not, but especially as we approach an animistic culture, as we've said before in this class, we don't tend to see religion as affecting all of our lives. Mm-hmm. So when someone is healed, we don't attribute it to religious causes, whereas the animist does. And I think if we were to more willingly say that, you know, it wasn't this drug or it wasn't this surgery, but it was God, that would... I don't particularly like the idea, you know, of people getting healed by some preacher in front of the church. But I think just as an approach, you know, to the animus, for us to be much more open about the reality of the supernatural world and its effect in every aspect, rather than saying, well, here's our hospital and that's where you get healed, and here's our church and this is where you get saved, and they're sort of...
That's helpful too. Please, Paulus.
I still believe that God is living. God has still power. He still performs miracles. But the problem is when somebody says, I'm able to manipulate God, you know, just as you are talking, that's when I have to disagree. Whether it's Oral Roberts or Robert Schuller or anybody. I think that
B.B. Warfield?
That would be the danger there.
Yeah. healing can become just one more form of divine manipulation. I don't want to cut this off because I have a feeling that this is worthwhile enough to put time in for you to get a chance to express yourselves. One of the things, I would have to say, I believe in divine healing, and I believe that God heals by miracle. I have absolutely no doubts of that at all. I think that God can do it without human intervention. I think God can still make blind people see, and he does. I think God can take deaf people who can't hear and make them hear, and he still does. I have a very full confidence in that. I think sometimes he will do that without human intervention, and sometimes he'll do it with. I guess one of the questions I have about often the emphases today on it is always, it seems, at least here in North America, the emphasis is on the need for an intervener, somebody like a mediator, a Roberts or someone else to put his hands on you. And I'm not sure that I think there may be samples of that, but I'm also concerned if those about those who may argue this is the only way God takes care of this supernatural intervention. There's where I start getting scared. And I wonder then whether this is falling over into the manipulation side. But I guess I feel, too, sometimes our legitimate concerns for the question of the conclusion of the canon and the cessation of divine revelation make us at the same time so uptight about about seeing God's direct intervention into human society that we really recoil from that. And though we say we believe it, when the chips are really down, it's very, very difficult for us to say, yes, God's doing this. And I guess I'm just describing some feelings of my own, looking back on my own reflections over 20 years or so. I saw things in Korea I saw nowhere, I've not seen here. I saw things in Korea that I never saw in my life before I went to Korea. I remember vividly, for example, working for years with a dynamic, very active layperson who used to drive the ambulance for the Christian Reformed Church mission work, the World Relief Commission in Korea. And a very vigorous evangelist. He used to play the accordion, and he had a he'd just start preaching the drop of a hat, and a very enthusiastic fellow. He used to drive the ambulance, and in his 40s. And finally, in the course of the Christian Reformed mission, had regular annual checkups for their medical people and or their workers. And this fellow took a medical exam, and I remember the doctor, a Dutch doctor, was working there, you know, hardy Dutchman, not from the United States, but straight over from the old country. And he came to talk to me, and he was struggling with this because this man had worked for them for years. And they discovered he's a terminal TB of the spine. He says, it's just, you know, it's right here. And even I could see it on the x-rays. There's nothing they could do. They couldn't carry, you know, continue to allow a man to be driver of the ambulance who was a virulent carrier of TB. So they had to let him go and made arrangements for the Korean equivalent of retirement salary. And the man said, that's all right. He said, the Lord is calling me into the pulpit ministry. So then this fellow, immediately after he was retired, since he had lots of money now, then he applied to enter our seminary, or the seminary where I was teaching. And in the course of it all, he had to get his x-rays all over again, and the x-rays, and I was on the admissions committee of the faculty, and I was trying to keep very quiet, and they came down to his name, and somebody said, we can't accept him, he's got TB. And so they said, okay, and we had to tell him, which is always very difficult. A very, very dynamic fellow, a lovely Christian. He says, oh, that's all right. He said, the Lord's leading me, and I'll be back. He said, God's going to heal me. And we all sat there, all this faculty. you know, all these Warfield-trained theologians. And then he took the money, and he gave it to all the money to his wife. The CR mission also provided him with TB medicine, which he threw away. Then he went up into the mountain, and for a year he lived in a cave. I kid you not, he spent 1 year in that cave fasting and praying for healing. And he lived very near to his wife, so he could keep constant contact with her. He ate just a minimum bread and water, and that's about it. And then he came back the following year for his exams, to once more to try to enroll in seminary. Now this time, we had the same Christian Reformed doctor we had asked to examine the x-rays of all the students. And I'll never forget the look in his face when he walked into the admissions room. And he said to me, "Harvey, you'll never believe this." He said, "Look at this x-ray." And he held it up. There wasn't a spot on the x-ray. And we admitted the student. Now he has, I think, a 3- or 4-story building church. And he's also, the last I heard, he had started a home for mentally ill on the streets. And he even had a home for the blind now. Church going great guns. Now, how did the Lord do that? And again, not human intervention. But there was a direct... a work of the Lord. God did it. I sometimes think we just almost, again, I guess it's sort of like Boving says, the whole secularist mind, you know, in which we work in the West, so really gets at us that no matter how much we really practically say, "I believe this, God can do this," it's still very hard when we come to grips when God actually does something as big and as marvelous as that.
Yeah. We need that little Tylenol to get rid of the headache.
Yes, right, right.
We really, God can only work through that.
Yeah. And we want to be sure also that we can tie up all the loose knots. I don't know, Hank?
Yeah, I agree with that. I've seen experiences like that. The two reservations I have, one is the human intervention, the necessity of it. I'm not saying I cannot use it. The necessity of it. So I would have some trouble with the Lasakla, these prophets that we see in our area. But the second thing that bothers me, and this is something that almost all of our preachers do, it's just something that they haven't been taught, but it's so closely related to what they've come out of. One of their main roles is to pray for the sick. And they do a lot of that, but they always always go right to the question of sin. And to the point that it seems like they believe that every sickness is directly related to sin, and if God doesn't heal, it's because of you haven't sincerely confessed your sin and so forth. And I have a lot of problem with that, and that's something that I haven't been able to help my African brethren with too much.
If you know, it's easy to understand that in terms of where it comes from animism.
Yeah.
You know, it's the animist is sure that a tear, a rent has taken place in the harmony of the creation, and it has to be due to something wrong that we've done. So that's just simply transposed into Christian thinking. I found at one stage that in doing evangelistic work in the Korean countryside, in looking for different topics to use in evangelistic meetings, that one of the most fruitful was a series of messages that I prepared on suffering and God's cure. And that allows you, through that particular thing, which I happen to think is very at the core of the Korean worldview, that allowed me to touch on many things that were deeply on every Korean's concern and mind, and also to deal with this whole animistic kind of question. And it seems to me there's where the teaching could come in about, the Lord said, the people who asked Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents? And the Lord's response, this was done that God's name might be glorified, which gives you a very different picture of how to see suffering and pain and even death within the cosmic order. God's glory is at the center even of our suffering. Not some vague spirit whom we're trying to control, but rather the God who is so big that he cannot be controlled. And maybe that needs to be, more teaching needs to be given in that area. I don't know. What about that? You raised another question, Hank. I don't want to leave this one, but I want to give you all an opportunity to feel like you can talk freely about this. I've opened up honestly because I think sometimes that helps you get it out. I have several other stories, but I'll save those for the commercial breaks.
There are two things that I've found out in terms of the Bible. One of them is that you don't have these announced healing meetings in the Bible. It's more spontaneous. Because I don't know if in the third world they have announced healing meetings, but I know America, you know, like in 2 weeks, Dennis Dangley is going to be in Philadelphia, you know, and he's going to heal them. But also that it always works in the Bible, with the exception maybe of the guy first he sees the trees walking and then later, but that was in the plan of the Lord to do. I don't even really know what that means, but a lot of healings I've seen where they say, well, it doesn't work, either you don't have enough faith, or you know, it'll work, just go home, keep believing it'll work, you know, throw your crutches away. But it doesn't seem that in the Bible. I mean, Zamo, you know, here, it works right away.
Yeah. Again, if, those are all helpful. If, again, I think it's interesting the way our discussions go. Let's, by all means, keep trying to show those areas, you know, through our study of the scripture, where false and true healing can be discerned. But even sometimes I think that it's still hard for us to come out and sort of publicly affirm, hey, God's really doing this. It's tough, you know. And we're not sure we should share this when we get home on furlough. helpful.
You said that you had seen things in Korea that you've not seen here, and you know that incident with the TV, I'm sure, is one of them. Why do you think that is? Because we have such a tight theological system
I guess I do.
We refuse to file it. Okay. You know, we believe it out front, but boy, really, I don't want to forget it.
Functionally, and when the chips are down, it's still tough to really say yes. We can find a theological place for it somewhere, you know, in the system. But whether we can actually say yes, I think that's why Korea was the first place in my experience where I saw this directly. I think since then I've had the benefit of being in the black churches and seeing what God does here in the United States. Very, very similar. But Korea was where I saw it first. And so that's what I was referring to by that. But I just want to keep encouraging us to affirm that and to hold that out as part of what God does. But again, it's got to be held out, as I think we're all urging, in proper biblical perspective. But what I'm sensing is that we don't even do it in that perspective, and that very seldom do I ever hear or see these kinds of things put on the missionary agenda in terms of the message that the missionary wants to give to his people. This I see is the profitable thing that at least Peter Wagner is trying to do now. He's forcing us to struggle with the reality of what these things mean in terms of the growth of the church. I frankly, at this point, I get a little frustrated at Pete, and I think to myself, good grief, where have we reached the stage where now we have to have a course taught in the seminary, you know, on how God heals? And that sort of scares me off a little bit, but at the same time I recognize that in the light of our own reluctance in these whole areas to even speak or work in this area, that those kinds of things are needed, if nothing else, and to challenge us and help us face the reality of what God really does. One more sample. For those of you who may be struggling with this from a theological point of view, let me mention one little minor point, and then I want to, I think we go back to Hank's question, which is an important one. Some of you, if you've read Warfield, Warfield seems to be the traditional around here The standard point of view for the idea that the age of miracles has ceased, his book Counterfeit Miracles. I'm not sure that that book is all that's altogether accurate description of that book by Warfield, but that's certainly the way it's been taken in most circles today. I guess I also feel that's one of the worst books that Warfield ever wrote, if not probably the worst, in terms both of his a real effort to grapple with biblical data. You know, you don't see in that book the tremendous wisdom of Warfield wrestling with the scriptures that you do in any of his other writings. It's quite that book is quite unique in that respect. Disappointing to me. There needs to be a lot of homework done in this very area that is much more careful. After having said all of that, one of the men here on the faculty of Westminster Seminary, who you could hardly accuse of being a disagreeer with Warfield or a violent opponent, was John Murray. In Murray's lecture notes, I think they're available still in mimeograph form at the seminary library. He has a section where he dealt with miracles. He never covered it that much, but I still remember after 30 years what he said very vividly. Murray argued that the term miracle properly had certain confining characteristics or, a conditioning circumference, whatever you want to call it. He argued that the term miracle should be restricted fairly severely to certain periods of biblical revelation. He commented that miracles, as a matter of fact, don't just sort of flow all through the scriptures, but they seem to cluster at certain periods of time in the Bible. And he distinguished those as periods of time which were called, in which specifically God was in conflict, as it were, in a specific, special way with supernatural forces. The time of the Exodus, for example, is one of those clusters. Another one was in the Old Testament would have been the ministry of Elijah and Elisha. Still another one would have been the ministry of Daniel in Babylon. And then, of course, the New Testament and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. And then we still wait, I think, for the final full concentration or cluster shortly before the second coming of our Lord, when there will be great signs and wonders in the earth. And Murray acknowledged all this. Well, when we sat around listening to all this, the sense was, well, then, is there any sense, our question would naturally arise, well, is there any sense then which we can talk about now and here and what's going on in the things we've seen before described as miraculous? And here Murray, a very precise man, was very reluctant to describe some of the things we've talked about as miraculous. But at the same time, Murray maintained a distinction which I have found to be helpful, and maybe some of us would think of this as just pure semantics, but knowing John Murray's carefulness, I don't want to attribute that to him at all. Murray argued that miracles are displays of God's extraordinary providence. Miracles are part of God's providence. There is his ordinary providence, there are miracles. And then, said Murray, as I remember his argument, in between the two, there were those things which Murray called God's extraordinary providence. He was introducing this distinction, I think, to preserve what he felt to be the biblical boundary lines for miracle as a term, and yet at the same time to maintain as well an openness for those special displays of the handiwork of God in our contemporary society. So what many of us in this last discussion would call miracles, John Murray would have called extraordinary providences of God. And he was very free about acknowledging that. One of the stories, whether apocryphal or not, which floated down to our students was this. John Murray, as you remember, had only one eye. And I used to drive with him the first year I was here down to church. it's a great experiment in faith, I guarantee it. And Murray told the story of the time when he was down, I think it was in the Kensington area where the church he attended was, and he was crossing one of the large streets down in the area. moving out in the intersection, and because of his blind eye, he did not see a car moving directly through the intersection from the other way. And there was going to be a collision. Suddenly, at the point of the collision, Murray's car stopped and the other car stopped. And John Murray insisted he never touched the brake pedal. He got out of the car and went to the other car, and the man got out of his car and said to John Murray, "What happened? I never touched the brake." Now, John Murray would call that an example of God's extraordinary providence. You can use whatever term you want to describe it, but I think there's some value in that kind of language if it's not used in any kind of scholastic way, and certainly John Murray never intended it to be such. But he did intend for us to see that there are open places within the providence of God that you can't fence off and say God can't work here. And not even the wisdom of a war field should help you do that in closing work. I have always found that to be helpful to me and opening.
Did he use the term extraordinary coincidence or providence?
Providence.
I've heard that same thing.